Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is John Arrington, a Detroit-born, North Carolina-raised, and Harvard-educated cinematographer and film director who has worked on a number of short films and is about to release a full-length feature on May 16th called A Long Way Off, a modern telling of the story of the prodigal son. He is also working on a film called Union Bound, which is slated to be released, about a year and a half from now. These look to be some very interesting theatrical experiences and ones that churches might use for different types of pastoral outreach or to spark some spiritual discussions. So we will provide a link to the website for the film A Long Way Off at our webpage, allowing you to track down more information. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
I want to start off by noting for our audience that this interview is a bit different from the typical fare that we offer here on the podcast, which is usually devoted to looking at scholarly studies of religious behavior and institutions. However, some of you longtime listeners will know that I like to mix things up a bit and throw in a few practitioners now and then, folks who live out their commitments to their faith and who offer insights to the world of religion from the ground level. John, you fit this bill in that regard, but I should also note that you have taught film production at the collegiate level, so you have the eyes of a trained academic as well.
Done a little bit of everything.
Okay, very cool. Where did you teach the film production courses?
Central Piedmont.
Okay.
College in Charlotte. It's a state-run university.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun teaching this stuff. So I should also note that I have a fascination with how religion is portrayed in the popular media, and including film. We've had a few podcasts in the past on film. And so when this opportunity to interview John arose, I jumped at it, particularly because I'm interested in this recent trend that you release spiritually based independent films and then market them through existing church networks. We might talk about that a little bit later on here in the podcast. But the first thing I want to do is give John the chance to pitch his new movie a little bit so that our discussion can have a little bit of context here. What is this movie, A Long Way Off, all about?
So just as you said, it is a modern retelling of the parable of the prodigal son. So essentially it is, point for point, the story of the parable adapted to a modern setting. Now, of course, the parable itself is very short, and there's, you know, hardly any detail, you know, especially when the son goes to the city. What did he do? How did he lose his money? How does he become destitute? None of that is really explained in the Bible. So, of course, we had to, you know, employ some creative license and invent a bit of a story, but as far as sort of the how closely we try to follow the Bible, where the Bible does say something, every point is in there. So he grows up on his family farm, he asks his father for his inheritance, and he goes to the big city, loses everything. Then he's so destitute, he ends up working on a pig farm and decides that anything would be better than where he is now, so he's going to return home and ask forgiveness.
And I have to ask, since you are filling in some of the backstory when he's in the city, are there any giant rock monsters that came out and helped him?
No rock monsters, no
All right.
No wild supernatural elements to our movie.
Okay, just keeping it basically
pretty
simple.
Pretty straightforward and pretty grounded in reality for that matter.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the details of the film, how it was filmed, the cast that you got a little bit later, but I want to, now that we have this context set here at the table, talk a little bit more about your background. But before even doing that, when is this film going to be released?
So we're premiering in L.A. May 6th, and then there's going to be a theatrical premiere around the country May 16th.
Okay. Where can we go see this? Now, you just said L.A. L.A. is a pretty big place. You get to release it there about a week and a half early, I would guess, or 2 weeks early. And then is this going to be at the local Cineplex, or am I going to have to go to special artsy theaters or things like that?
It'll probably be artsy theaters. In terms of sort of a more widespread theatrical release. I know they're still working out the details on that, and that'll probably come around later this summer. The event on the 16th is about a 20-city screening. So there'll be theaters in 20 cities that will show the film. And then later this summer, it should have a broader release. But yeah, just like you said, in the art house type theaters, and then it'll be available on DVD in August.
Oh, okay, that's very interesting. It's released in multiple stages like that. That there's a 20 stage. Yeah, you hear that sometimes with some films. You know, if it's not the big Spider-Man 3 or something like that, which is released all at once, that you have these rollouts that are occurring. And why choose to release it in Los Angeles? Is just that's a Hollywood thing, and that's what everybody does, or
it is. I mean. To a certain extent, it gives a film legitimacy. I mean, everybody still looks at what's coming out of Hollywood, even though in the independent and the studio world, you know, there's not as many films are being made in Los Angeles today as what used to be. You know, estate tax incentives, and there's a lot of really attractive offers to get studios and independents to be making their movies all over the country, but still, and everybody's perception, and you know, all the executive offices of all the executives are from the studios. They're all still in L.A., so there's still that really strong, you know, perception that you're not legitimate unless you're connected to Los Angeles somehow.
Yeah, no, I know they make a lot of films up in Vancouver, Canada. And so we have a lot of that going on. They attract folks across the border. In terms of the release in Los Angeles, are you releasing it in Westwood? What theaters are you going to?
Yes,
you know?
It's going to show at the Landmark Theater.
Okay, see, that's my old stomping ground when I was at UCLA. So say hi to everybody there. Yeah, very cool. I should, and well, we'll get to this later when we talk about the film. I'm curious about where it is filmed, if you did film it in Los Angeles or not. But we'll save that for a teaser right now. I want to back off a little bit and talk about you, because you're the guy who directs this film, and the people who have their hands on the film, especially the writers, the producers, and the directors, oftentimes are able to shape the story. So I want to kind of know what is happening with you in your life and how you got to this point to release this film. And from your bio on the Internet Movie Database, all I can gather is that you have a bachelor's from Harvard in history and literature and a master's from that same esteemed institution in comparative literature. Now, the first obvious question is, did you know Jeremy Lin at Harvard?
No, he was he's a little younger than me.
Oh, okay.
I graduated in 2005.
Okay, all right. I'll give you that. But then here's the more important question. This is a curious one. How does a kid go from being born in Detroit to North Carolina and then to Harvard?
A lot of hard work, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I went to very good. Very good prep school and worked hard and took a lot of advanced placement courses and, you know, applied almost on a whim. A friend of mine had attended Harvard does a summer school program for rising high school seniors. So you spend 8 weeks on campus and take classes, at the college level. And, excuse me, a good friend of mine who is a year older had attended it and loved it and recommended it to me, so I ended up going and kind of fell in love with it and decided I would apply and got in, and sort of the rest is history.
There you go. I guess if you go up to that program, you just don't leave the campus and you say, you might as well enroll me because I'm not moving anywhere. So
it's hard to. It was really hard to, yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask this about your own personal religious background, if I may. You are filming a religious film, and so I'm curious about your own past. Did you grow up in a religious household, or are you a secular Richard Dawkins guy, say, hey, I'm just going to film some religious movies? What's your faith background?
it's a little all over the place. I personally identify as being very faithful, although I'm not overly religious, if I can draw that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't attend church every week and that sort of thing, but, you know, I'm very, very interested in, you know, in the Bible and Christianity and in biblical matters. So, you know, I identify more as being a person of faith than having to specifically adhere to, and, you know, the practice and the doctrine of a particular denomination or religion. I mean, I am Catholic, but I guess, as so many of us say, we're kind of a lapsed Catholic. But having said all of that, a lot of my professional work has been in the faith-based market. There have been probably 3 or 4 feature-length films that I've worked on that have all been faith-based. And one of sort of my other professional endeavors is I've been involved in putting on a number of award shows for various Christian music organizations.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
And I actually through one of those, it was an award show called and it's called The Award Goes to A Look Back at the Legends. It was kind of a retrospective and sort of Hall of Fame induction for Christian musicians. I actually won an Emmy for my work on that show. So,
oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's a little different from my standard fare of working on, you know, narrative,
yeah,
storytelling type films. You know, but I'm, like I say, professionally, I'm a little all over the place.
So, do you have your Emmy, you know, up on a fireplace mantle or something?
It's actually my parents' house. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I bet your parents are really proud about that. That's very cool.
Very much. Yeah.
What did your parents do, actually, if I may ask?
My father's a physician, and my mother raised my sister and me.
Okay. And their kid is now making movies. Are your parents okay with that? Because I think most people say, oh, I'm going to have my kid go into Hollywood, and the parents would kind of shriek.
I think they are. I think they've been very supportive.
Excellent.
Very supportive and very behind me over the years and still are. And I think they're thrilled to see, you know, some of these projects. It's tough sort of getting somebody acclimated to this industry who's not used to it, because, you know, projects can take years and years and years before, you know, from the time it starts to the time it releases and it's out. And, you know, the idea that, you know, I've not been working in film for that long, but I guess it was 2008 really when I started after film school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's family, friends, everybody, you know, so when are we going to see something you worked on? When are you going to say, well, it's coming. You know, so it's taking a little bit for some of these projects to get out there. But, you know, that time is rolling around, and, you know, 2014, 2015, hopefully these are going to be some good years for me.
Very cool. And if anybody questions you too much, you could say, have you polished that Emmy, Mom and Dad? How's that doing? Yeah, it's been making some progress.
Exactly. Here. Yes, I have that card in my pocket.
So you mentioned film school, but I'm looking again at your bio, and you're at Harvard in history and literature, and then you took a master's in comparative literature. When you walked onto those hallowed grounds of Harvard University, did you have any idea that you were going to go into the film industry, and how did you boomerang this interest in history and literature into film?
The first couple of years I was there, no, I had no idea that I would end up going into film. I'd always been kind of in and around entertainment, and for a while though, I was considering going into academia at some point. My undergraduate field is medieval history and literature, and I had sort of a focus on Anglo-Saxon England and Scandinavian, but Norse Scandinavia. And then there was, you know, very strong, obviously medieval historical component to my studies. But I worked at the radio station. I sang in, I think, 4 operas while I was in school. I had sort of always been around the arts. And it was at a point in my junior year when a very good friend of mine, who's actually a screenwriter now, he and I decided that we wanted to make a short film. We were both kind of interested, and we thought we'd try it out. It wasn't for a class. It was completely extracurricular. And going through the process of making the film, of writing it, casting it, finding the locations, shooting it, editing it, and, you know, having that finished product out of nothing, you know, we're just two guys sitting in a room talking about this idea, and, you know, 3 months later, we've got a finished film that we can show people. I fell in love with the whole process, and he was talking about possibly going to film school. I had a couple other friends who were talking about doing it. So I, at that point, I knew that I was entirely bitten by the bug. And, you know, like I said, I had worked for the radio station at Harvard for a few years. I was very involved in that. So, you know, the idea of producing content and media and entertainment is not totally off the wall. But all that being said, the way that kind of ties into to what I've been studying academically, I mean, I'm my love first and foremost is stories and mm-hmm. storytelling, and you know, from doing comparative literature and undergraduate studies, and one of the areas that I got particularly interested in is how the same story will change when it's told either in different cultures or at different times. Hmm. So you take a particular story tradition and you look at the way it's being told is reflecting, you know, different different issues of the people who are telling it. So with that in mind, when you look at how movies are made, there's a lot of similarity to that. They say that every movie is written, or the story of every movie is told three times. Once when it's written, once when it's shot, and once when it's edited.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if you ascribe to sort of reader reception theory, then it's told the fourth time when an audience sees it.
Yeah.
And they interpret it how they will. So, you know, this idea that a story can be, you know, many things at the same time, I think, is kind of an underlying interest of mine that, you know, mm-hmm. keeps me coming back.
I'm amazed that you're sitting around and you're shooting the breeze with your friends and you said, let's make a film. And then 3 months later, you have a short film. I mean, first of all, the technology to do this is just becoming increasingly more accessible. My own 14-year-old kid is making, you know, short movies and you know, putting them up on his computer, and I'm kind of amazed at how he's doing that. First of all, tell me what you did. A number of other short films too. What was the content of these short films, and then how does this get you to the point where you are directing a major theatrical release?
I mean, kind of like the jobs that I've occupied have been all over the place. I've written, I've produced, I've done a lot of cinematography. I've directed. I've edited, so, you know, gathering that sort of body of background of technical experience, coupled with as I've been working and as I've been sort of growing in the industry, any project that would come along, I'd take. And, you know, I was working on some documentary projects while I was teaching. We shot, you know, we did a documentary on the Duke Energy Center, which is the newest LEED LEED Platinum certified building that was built in downtown Charlotte by Wells Fargo. I guess it was Wachovia at the time. So I've done documentaries, the short films, or sort of anything from drama. I've been a cinematographer on a little series of shorts that are up on Funny or Die that are doing really well, actually. The George and Monty series.
Oh, okay. I don't
know, if you can Google that, George and Monty, Funny or Die, and those will come up there.
We'll go ahead.
Some are a little irreverent, but they're fun and they're easy to shoot, and I've enjoyed working on them.
We'll go ahead and link to those on our website for people who want to see that. Yeah, my son will like that. He gets on that site a lot. So, what was the very first short movie you did with your friend after shooting The Breeze and saying, let's film?
Yeah, it was actually called, As Love Does. We did it as a submission to the Gershwin Film Festival, I think in Vail, Colorado, if I'm not mistaken. Andrew Zdrowski, my friend and screenwriter, he has a screenplay that looks like it's going to be produced this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Holland, Michigan, it's called. I was just talking to him yesterday a little bit about it. I'm very, very happy for him. He came across this film festival, and we decided that we would we'd make a film and submit it. So it's the song that we set it to is Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, where I Say Tomato, I Say Tomato. So it's about this our film version is about this inability to communicate. So our main character is in a relationship, and he's sort of questioning whether or not he needs to continue with it or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is kind of interesting. That's one of those things you got to save in the closet, so when you are making, you know, the next installment in the Spider-Man movies, you can, you know, pull it out and say, this is where I all began. It's one of those cool things. And your story is one of these very interesting stories to me, that you just keep plugging away at doing a lot of different stuff. I noticed on the IMDb profile of yours that it says you also participated in different activities such as miscellaneous film crew, and I'm assuming that stuff like going in getting coffee for people, right?
Yeah. Right. I think that designation is on IMDb.com. It's kind of a catch-all for all the other positions, and I think for me that was an office PA / assistant accountant position on a film Blood Done by My Name.
Okay, yeah, you see that as you watch the credits scroll at the end. You got all those folks involved in that. But you know, here you are going from being the office accountant to being the director of this film A Long Way Off, and that seems to be a pretty big leap. And so I want to talk about how you got to that and how the film actually came about. So how did you get to be the director, and where did the idea for this film come about? Were you approached by others, or was this your own idea?
No, it was not my idea. And sort of the trajectory goes something like this, that this was my third feature with Uptone Pictures, with this particular production company, and each picture I've sort of been taking on more and more responsibility. So the first one I was a focus puller in the camera department, and I ended up as the second unit director of photography for about 10% of the movie. And then their second film, Destiny Road, I was the director of photography for the whole film. And then you had mentioned Union Bound, which I'm about to be working on. I was actually hired by them to write Union Bound and possibly direct it. So I had finished the script, we were scouting locations, and the producers had just started the search for financing when this script, A Long Way Off, came into their door. And the executive producers, Jerry and Christy McLaughlin, they had already raised the money, they had the script, they kind of brought the project to Uptone Pictures and said, we need you to produce this. And because I was already working with Uptone Pictures in the capacity of a director, and they knew, they were familiar with my work as a cinematographer as well, they asked me if I would go ahead, because they needed to produce this right away, so they asked me if I would go ahead and move over onto this project and direct and DP it.
So they needed to do it right away. Is there any reason for doing that? And why did they pick this story about the prodigal son? Why not do a film about, I don't know, Noah?
Well, probably at the time, I think Noah was already underway.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
having that story told, if you want to say it that way, somewhere else in Hollywood. But I from my understanding, I think it's a story that I guess it's very I don't want to say personal, because I think that starts to imply things, but it's a very powerful story, and I think it's a story that the executive producers wanted to have told, and they recognized that there really isn't a movie that's been made that tells the story of the prodigal son, but tells it in such a way that follows the Bible as closely as possible. So I think that was, you know, their idea and their want to make the movie. And I know that they want to make other films that are all biblically based, similar to A Long Way Off. That you know, they're identifying some of these great story opportunities from the Bible, and they want to make the movies, you know, for everybody to enjoy.
Yeah, I noticed that the release of Long Way Off is, you know, approaching Mother's Day and Father's Day. It seems to be a ideal point to release it. Was there some consideration on that? Let's get this thing done so that we can have it for Mother's and Father's Day. It's a parent-child relationship story.
Absolutely. Okay. I think that was part of, originally that was part of the intent. to shoot it. Kind of, you know, we have to do it now. We have to shoot it by the end of the year so we can. It was twofold. We wanted to shoot it by the end of the year so that it would be ready for some sort of distribution in time for Father's Day. Is really, I think, what they're going for.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is what you would call an independent film. It's not from a major studio. If you look at the website, and we're going to point people to the website so they can see the film. There's some trailers and information about the film and ways that churches can get involved and things like that. It's listed and in a couple different ways. I never really understood this with movies. Maybe you can explain it, but there's different companies or associations or organizations that are affiliated with the movie. You have listed here Word Films, Prodigal Productions, LLC, and then Uptone Pictures. So explain what all those different parts are and why you see, you know, these different organizations combining to make this film.
Right. I mean, it's every film project is kind of it's a new business entity that gets created. Mm. And depending on who's coming to the table to take part, you know, their various companies will be represented sort of in the deal. So Uptone Pictures is the existing production company. They Mike Davis is a owner, and he's a producer on the film. They're the company. I've done work with them on three coming up, about to do four films now. So they're the production company that takes care of the actual physical production, making of the movie, hiring people, that sort of thing. The Prodigal Films is the company that is the movie. And then Word Films is the distributor. They're actually a subsidiary of Warner Brothers.
Mm.
So they're the ones that are sort of taking care of, you know, getting it placed in theaters, having the DVDs made, you know, all of the distribution side of things.
So this is interesting to me because, again, you make a very good case. I never thought of this. Each film is really an independent business enterprise with a lot of different people and organizations coming in to make it. But you say Word Films is the distributor underneath Warner Brothers, you know, so a subsidiary or a franchise or something like that. Does that still qualify as an independent film if you got somebody like Warner Brothers floating out there in the background?
It does. I mean, I guess the big distinction between a studio film and an independent film is where the financing comes from and who is producing it.
Okay.
So an independent film is technically classified as any film that is not financed by one of the major studios. Okay. And it can be produced by anybody. Then when everybody, you know, when all said and done, the movie's made, and you need to take on distribution, you know, you can still go and find all the major studios have sort of an independent distribution wing,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it's one of their one or a group of their subsidiary companies that specifically go to film festivals. They look for these independently produced and made films, and they essentially acquire the distribution rights to distribute the film. So the films are still independent. You know, like I said, independently financed and independently made, but they may be distributed or picked up by one of the studios.
Okay, and that's kind of interesting. I never heard Word Films was a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. I never would have guessed that. There's probably a dozen or two dozen distribution things that, you know.
They're probably closer to 70 or 80.
Wow! Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Well, so. Yeah, the big studios, the big names that you hear, the Warner Brothers, the Sony, you know, they're kind of they're umbrella corporations, and they own a lot of different companies that are subdivided into a lot of very specific, you know, sort of either niche products or markets.
Mm-hmm.
So Word Films, Word Entertainment and Word Films now, they have traditionally done distribution for Christian music, but they're transitioning into, or they're broadening their expanse into taking on movies as well. So they have kind of a background history with Christian music, but they're getting into distributing films.
Okay, now here's one question that we had brought up earlier, and I said we'd come back to, and that is, where is the film actually filmed? I know that, you know, if you work with a major studio, you have access to the big studio lots that everybody tours and all that kind of stuff, but is that where you guys did it, in Los Angeles? Did you film in Vancouver, British Columbia, or where?
We actually shot in Raleigh, North Carolina. The setting of the film is never, it's never said where the film takes place in the movie. And we did that because we feel like it needs to be a universal story that anybody could watch from anywhere and feel like it's happening anywhere. So we didn't want to name, you know, what city Jake actually travels to and where he gets into trouble. But our locations were all in and around probably a 30-mile radius of Raleigh.
Okay. And did you choose that because they gave you tax breaks, or just Raleigh looks like everywhere USA?
A bit of both. Upzone Pictures, they have their offices just outside Raleigh, and the executive producers are all from Raleigh. So there was a strong push to make the film locally. But I think it's one of the modus operandi for Upzone, and for me, generally speaking, as well, to make movies in North Carolina. Over the last few years, we've had a very competitive tax incentive in the state. There's some questions now. The tax incentive has a sunset at the end of this year, and we're sort of waiting on our legislators to vote on keeping it. So we'll see how that plays out. But it was a number of factors, I guess, that influenced the shooting of the film in Raleigh.
Yeah. Now here's the big surprise in the film. So you shot it at Raleigh. It seems to be fairly cheap and things like that. And you would think that an independent film is also going to take a lot of unknown actors and actresses, just pull people off the street because, hey, we're on a tight shoestring budget, and who really wants to work on an independent film anyways? But when you go to the website and you find out who's in this film, you'll be floored. I was really stunned. I recognized faces immediately. And some of the folks that you have in here is Robert Davi, who was most famous for his portrayal of the villain in the James Bond film License to Kill. And if you go to the website and look at him, he's been in a thousand films, I think. He's always kind of playing the bad guy. Then there's Edie McClurg, and that's a name that I wouldn't recognize, but as soon as you see the picture, it's like, okay, I've seen her in a thousand different films and television series too. She was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And she does a lot of voiceover work most recently in the big hit animated film Frozen. So she's all over the place. You got John Deal. People will recognize him from Stargate, A Time to Kill. And then Zoe Meyer is also listed up there. She was recently with a smaller role in Anchorman 2. So you're pulling in some names here.
Yeah. I mean, everybody who sort of came together to make the film, we've all been working in the industry a little bit, and as you work, you start to meet people. And I know Robert Davi was, I think he's a friend, or he knows our executive producers, so they were able to talk to him and get the script to him and get him interested in being in the film. John Deal, I think, one of our assistant directors had worked with him on another project and had his name and number and gave it to us, so we were able to get in touch with him that way. So it's just, it's a matter of sort of casting the net over of everyone's network and, finding the right people, getting the script to the right people, and getting them interested.
And how did you get some of these people involved? Because I think some of Robert Davi would be like, oh, it's an independent Christian film. I mean, is there, you mentioned that there's some connection with the folks at Upzone Pictures and that is, I mean, are these folks practicing Christians? Were they looking for something different to do? It's like, yeah, I'd really like to do a faith-based film. I've done all these James Bond films before. Or one would almost think, too, that sometimes taking some of these roles would be a career killer for some of these folks, that it's a little tiny, dinky film. Oh, you must be on the way down the ladder here, and it's, you're a Christian, so you're not going to star in the next big, violent, R-rated film or something like that. Is there a challenge in that, or are some of these people just really excited about doing a film like this?
No, there definitely can be. And, you know, when you're talking about working in independent film, that can mean so many different things to so many people. You know, it could be somebody's making an independent film and they only have, you know, $15,000-$20,000, and they just have a little DSLR and no lights. And, you know, I can imagine for some of these actors, they really don't know what they're walking into when they agree to work on a project. And it's not just the faith-based component that can be a career killer. It's you know, who's doing it and what have they done and that sort of thing. I mean, with Uptown, our last movie, Destiny Road, has been doing exceptionally well in Brazil, actually. I think they're working on putting together a North America release for it. So, you know, sort of based on the strength of that, based on the strength of some of the other attachments, then, you know, you're able to bring people in because they see and they trust that, okay, other people who have done some things or who know what they're doing or who are good are working on this. You know, I believe that this is going to be a good project. Jason Berkey, our lead, who plays Jake, our prodigal son, he was the male lead in October Baby, which was the highest grossing theatrically released Christian independent film of, I don't want to say 2011 or 2012. I forget when it came out. But, you know, we got him involved and, you know, sort of bit by bit, once each actor hears about what the other's doing and sort of everything falls into place.
So, you know, folks like Jason, who's playing your lead role, he's had some experience here in the Christian filmmaking business. And, mm-hmm. you know, are a lot of these folks on board with the Christian message are really enthusiastic? Might they take a pay cut in order to, I really want to tell this message? And is there any concern about, well, this is going to brand me as a certain type of actor or actress. And if I just do Christian films, boy, do I limit my career opportunities down the road.
I think for some people there definitely can be that perception. It's not something that certainly frightens me or concerns me. I mean, like I said, I've done a fair bit of work in the faith-based market, but I've also done a lot of work on secular projects. You know, and I don't really see there to be a career-killing aspect to working on these kinds of films myself. I mean, for me, it's about, you know, finding an interesting story and finding a great way or great ways to tell it. And I think a lot of us have kind of identified there is a definite lack of quality in a lot of faith-based production. I think what ends up happening is, you know, you have people who may not be very experienced, but they're very passionate about wanting to tell a particular story. So they you know, are able to raise the funds. Sometimes, you know, a church might produce, decide to produce a film, and they get the money together, and okay, we're going to do it. But nobody really knows the nuts and bolts of how to make a movie. So, you know, when we came up with doing this film, you know, we decided that we were going to. I mean, the crew is comprised of people from kind of all walks of life, but we're all filmmakers and storytellers, and we know how to come together and tell a story and get across whatever its message is the most effective way possible. So, you know, just because we're working on a Christian film doesn't mean, I think for most of us, we feel like we're necessarily branded or ostracized from working on anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, that project I feel is going to benefit because, you know, you're going to have a higher production value because you're bringing people together who have more experience in telling stories.
Yeah. I'm starting to see this in the Christian film market. now. And I have to say, from my vantage point, whenever I hear a film being marketed as a Christian film, I automatically think, well, this is the Hallmark TV series from the 1970s. It's going to be real sappy and, you know, there's not going to be much edge to it. And you can imagine that's going to have a limited audience for that kind of thing. Cause, you know, people want a little bit of edge to their movie. They, you know, I do. I'm a big fan of the Die Hard series. So, I consider Die Hard 1 and 2 to be my two favorite Christmas movies. So, how did you tell the story? You mentioned that you take a little bit of liberties filling in some of the background story of the prodigal son, because again, it is fairly short, you know, parable there in the Bible, in the, Gospel of Luke, and now all of a sudden you got to extend this to an hour and a half, 2 hour film. How did you do that? Tell us a little bit about the plot line and how the writing of this developed.
Right. Well, let's see where to start. It's a great question. You got to think where to start now. I mean, in terms of the writing and sort of the genesis of the project, like I said, I came on board sort of after the script had been, you know, basically written. So all the major elements were there, and at the point in time when I was attached to the project, there were a couple sort of versions of the script floating around, and I did some work to try and synthesize everything. You know, we sort of use the Bible parable as the framework. So, like I mentioned earlier, all the major beats of the story are in our movie. So, with that as a layout, you know, now we have to invent characters, we have to invent scenarios for the characters to get into. You know, and based on, you know, some of the severity of what happens to the son when he leaves, you know, he takes his inheritance and he goes to the city and he loses everything. And, you know, as a biblical parable, you know, what does it mean that he loses everything? And it can't just be money. Obviously, he's involved in sin of some kind. You know, so for our character, he goes to the city and he gets involved in some, you know, terrible investments. He gets involved with some unsavory characters, cue Robert Davi, who plays Frank, kind of our villain in the film. You know, he's blowing money on women and parties and, you know, expensive cars and gifts and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, when his world comes crashing down, then none of these friends who were his friends for the while, are there for him anymore. So he becomes sort of destitute, and he's, you know, rifling through trash cans for something to eat.
But when you're doing these scenes where he's in the big city and he's running into unsavory characters and doing unsavory activities, yeah, you know, how do you balance the fact that you do want to show, you know, the reality of that kind of lifestyle versus the audience that you're after? You know, you could go in an R to almost an, you know, NC-17 direction. But, you know, okay, that's going to dissuade some people in our market category to see this film. So how do you balance that?
Absolutely. It was definitely a balancing act. And, you know, my take on it and my intention was to create a film that's a little bit more edgy. It's not necessarily, like you were saying earlier, it's not your typical sort of Hallmark style feel good story. Now, you know, it has those moments. It has, you know, very, very warm, very, very heartfelt. You know, I've seen plenty of tears in the audiences of some of our screenings by the end of the film. You know, so it definitely has that that aspect to it. But you know, it's, and I know this is drawing a very extreme example, but I think it illustrates the point. You know, one of the most interesting things about the movie, either Jaws or Alien, is you don't see the monster very much. So there's a lot that's left to your imagination. And one of the ways that we sort of got around, you know, showing Jake living this lifestyle is there's little hints of what he's doing and what's going on. you know, he walks in his apartment door with a girl and you don't see anything, but you know what happened. You know, you see him in the parties and you see sort of all this stuff around, but we're not, there's nothing that's gratuitous. I mean, I'm probably painting a much harsher picture of the film than what the reality is.
I got to tell you from an audience perspective, and so I'm kind of part of your market here. I do like that you don't show it explicitly. It's pretty cool that you're just hinting at it. And that's the thing that always tends to draw me into a movie. I mean, I was a big fan of all the old time 1950s and 60s monster movies, and you didn't get to see the monster until about three quarters of the way through. And that always kept you on the edge, right? And you're right. It forces the audience to use their imagination to actually work with the film instead of having the film do all the work for them. And that makes it, I think, a much, much better entertainment experience.
Right. I agree completely. So there's, you know, in the actual watching of A Long Way Off, it's very much as a family friendly, you know, everybody can sit down. There's no profanity. There's nothing that's shown. But like I said, you know, and they even do this in animated children's movies. I mean, you watch films like Shrek or some of the Pixar films. You know, there's little jokes or little hints that an adult will pick up on that the kids aren't getting, but the adult knows a lot more of the context around, you know, what that joke is.
Yeah.
You know, so it's much more along those lines where it certainly can be enjoyed by you know, just about anybody in the family. But
yeah, movies.
But no, we wanted to try and keep it still, you know, a little bit fresh, a little bit real. So I think one of the aims of the executive producers for the film is that it's able to start a dialogue. You know, you can use the film, and I know that they're getting this way with their marketing, where the film could be used to start discussions about faith, about, you know, not only sort of an exegetical process of looking at the Bible, but also of examining ourselves. And, you know, so many people have some kind of a connection to one of these characters. And I believe it's a long line where, you know, we either are a prodigal son or we know one or we're waiting for one to come home.
Yeah.
So there, you know, there's something to be gotten out of the film by anybody.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to that issue of marketing now, because this is one of the things that really fascinates me. And I know you're the director, guy, so you're not responsible for marketing, but you're around the audiences that are thinking about this. And so there's discussions about these things. And one of the fascinating things that I've seen happen over the last decade or so, especially with a lot of these independent Christian filmmakers, you know, Fireproof is oftentimes used as the big example of this, is the different ways that they're trying to market. You know, typically you think, well, a movie is produced, you throw it into the theater, you put up a lot of billboards in Hollywood, you know, post it on the Super Bowl ads or all that kind of stuff. But there's an interesting dynamic occurring in a lot of these independent film, especially Christian film movies, is they're trying to take advantage of pre-existing networks such as churches and get them involved in generating some buzz and either getting their audiences to a private screening or to actually have one of the screenings at the local church. How is this all working in? I mean, from your vantage point as a director, what are you seeing there?
Well, yeah, I think you know, the way that films are being communicated to audiences is changing a lot. And, you know, with the rise of Facebook and social media, you know, there's much more of a dependence, you know, from small movies right on up to the, you know, major Hollywood releases with, you know, all the Marvel films. And, you know, they're depending on the sort of word of mouth social network, to get the word out about, you know, how great the movie is or how everybody, you know, they generate a buzz and everybody has to see it. And I think for our film, specifically for Christian films in general, you know, looking at the pre-existing church networks is just one other sort of, I mean, I hate to reduce it to a comparison with social media, but you know, I think that the comparison is at least apt in some regard.
Oh, no, that's no problem. As a social scientist, yeah, I use that all the time. I people talk to me about the way I study churches as organizations. I said, churches are some of the original Facebooks, right? They're the original social medias where things spread really quickly. And, you know, you sit down and you think about, oh, yeah, it's kind of a natural in for the way to spread ideas and different types of activities and movements. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, for instance, for our movie, I know that that one of the things that they're organizing are church, specifically church screenings, ways for churches to license the film to host a viewing, you know, at their facility. So there's information in that regard on the website, alongwayoffthemovie.com. So, you know, just go to the website and see, click on the link there, and it'll provide information and who to contact to be able to host an event.
Yeah, we'll be posting that link. Yeah, we'll be posting that link on our website. And I want to encourage readers or listeners to go and look at that, not necessarily because you might want to get the film for your church, although that'd be a great idea to do that. You know, if you're a church elder or a clergy person or just a regular congregant and say, hey, this would be a really cool pastoral outreach thing. It's cool. But even just for, you know, folks who are curious about the marketing of this, it just going through the different pages on that website to see, okay, this is how we're going to get the information out. It's a really interesting sociological study of how a message, and in this case, a Christian message, is spread throughout different parts of the population. It's really kind of cool. I want to spend our last few minutes here with a few reflections that you have about Hollywood and Christian films in general. We've talked to some people in the past before about this, Michael Medved and a few other folks, and we'll link to those podcasts as well. But you're an insider to this field. You're still pretty young, and so you have a different vantage point than a lot of different people. But how do you see Hollywood in general, not just the physical place Hollywood, but the whole film industry, entertainment industry, taking to the religious market? And this is coming on the heels of the Noah movie. It had a lot of controversy, people saying, well, you know, they're just pandering to the religious thing. If you slap Noah onto a movie title and then make it look like Transformers or something like that, you know, everybody will flock out to see it and have a religious experience. But on the other hand, you have, you know, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. You have other successful mainstream films like The Blind Side. And then you even have films like Man of Steel, which was one of my favorite films last year, is the retelling of the Superman film. And you look at that, and there's nothing overtly Christian about it, but you say, oh, you know, this really picks up themes from the Bible and tells them in a different story. I mean, some people might see it a little bit sacrilegious to tell it in the guise of a comic book thing, but the Bible is a really great font for a lot of great stories, you know, stories that tell us a lot about ourselves as individuals and our relationship to the transcendent. And so it seems like Hollywood is kind of picking up on some of this. But on the other hand, a lot of people say, nah, they're kind of overlooking that heartland Christian audience. What's your take on this?
Gosh, it's a very complicated issue. We could probably do another hour's interview on this topic alone. But I agree with a lot of what you say. There are so many, you know, really great stories that can be taken from the Bible and told and retold. And I mean, I think what you took the words out of my mouth. The Bible is absolutely a font for a lot of great stories. And I think that, you know, Hollywood has recognized that, and it's not a new thing. You know, there have been biblical movies or Bible movies, you know, the Ten Commandments, the Robe. I mean, you know, for years and years and years, it's not something that's just cropping up. But I think the idea of sort of really trying to branch out and speak to that market specifically is something that's a little newer and it's interesting. And you know, for better or worse, and I guess it really comes down to the individual, you know, Hollywood and the movie industry is just that. It is an entertainment industry. It is a business, and there are always going to be people out there looking to make money. so, you know, this recognition that there is, a very strong paying movie-going audience out there who are looking for films like this. I think that there are people who are trying to, capitalize on that market. However, at the same time, I think there's projects like ours which, you know, recognize that that's going on, but at the same time recognize that the messages are getting a little skewed. And I think that was kind of that's really at the core of what A Long Way Off is as a film. I'll say it again, we did try as best we can, you know, with the scant details that are in the Bible. We tried to follow the Bible as closely as possible. Now, the film itself is not, I don't feel like it's overly preachy. It's not, it doesn't kind of hit you over the head with any particular one message, or it's not denominationally oriented. It's a little bit more universal, at least in my interpretation, which I think is a good thing. I think anybody from any denomination and, you know, honestly, any faith could probably watch the movie, not feel offended by anything, because I know, a lot of individuals can be very, very careful about what, you know, how they want their Bible reflected to them, I guess is a good way to put it. But I feel that our film is open enough, and it follows the parable kind of as a parable. It's not, different people can take something different out of it, and I think that there are interesting talking points for anybody. I think what we're trying to do, you know, we are in the middle of a little bit of a resurgence of, you know, biblically inspired or faith-based or Christian-inspired films, with, you know, God's Not Dead coming out. Of course, you mentioned Noah and its little controversy. Heaven Is For Real is coming out pretty soon, and then our movie this summer.
And a lot of these are from these independent filmmakers. I mean, the cost of making a film is still expensive, but they've come down relative to, say, 20, 30 years ago. The technology is much cheaper. The tools that you have at your disposal are much better, more sophisticated. Do you see these small independent movie houses really challenging the big dogs there in Hollywood and changing the way that films are made?
I do. I think... And it's not just in how films are made, but it's in how they're distributed. When you take a film like ours, and we're able to reach out directly to, you know, church audiences and to individuals, and, you know, to help spread the word that way, we're not dependent on being noticed and being picked up by one of the major studios. Otherwise, nobody's going to see our film. You're absolutely right. The cost of making movies has decreased fairly significantly. So the ability for anybody to go out and make a movie is still there. Now, that being said, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, there is a lot of technical know-how that is kind of required amongst, you know, everybody who's working in their various departments. So, just because anybody can go out and make a movie doesn't mean that their movie is going to be, you know, of the highest quality. So there's still an advantage to having, you know, experienced storytellers attached to the project. But yeah, I think the movie studios are starting to feel the same thing that the music industry was feeling. Or is feeling and has been feeling for a while, where, you know, a lot of younger musicians now, they're leveraging the social networks and they're leveraging, you know, websites to gain popularity and get themselves noticed. And then, still today, the major record labels are, you know, they're still looking for the people who have, you know, a million followers on Facebook. And, oh, these guys already have a following. We'll go ahead and sign them. We'll pick them up. I think that, that same kind of direction is happening with independent film. And, you know, it's going to become the Netflix and the, you know, the other sort of online distribution platforms for motion picture content. They're going to start to go directly to the source, as it were. They're not just going to depend on a pipeline from the major studios. So there is definitely an increased ability for new voices to get heard.
Very cool. I just want to finish up here with giving you the opportunity to tell us what's up next for John Arrington. You got this film, Union Unbound, that is supposed to be coming out. There's very little information about what it is. It seems like a top secret project. You want to give us a little indication of what's up for you in the near term future here?
Right. So Union Bound is a Civil War period film. It's based on a true story. I don't want to reveal too much about the story, but yeah, we're going to be filming probably starting in another month. I wrote the project, and I will be the cinematographer for the project as well. It's a Union soldier is captured in the Battle of the Wilderness and interred in Confederate stockades. He ends up escaping and then makes his way overland back to the Union lines at New Bern. And it's a really wonderful story. The amazing thing is I was able to adapt the story directly from the diaries of this soldier, who the diaries have been passed down in his family and have ended up with this, you know, delightful couple who live in Wake Forest, North Carolina. They approached Uptown Pictures, the producers, with these diaries and said, you know, we think there may be a story here. I don't know. Are you interested? And they got excited and they called me because of my background with working with historical documents and that I'm also a writer, so they asked me if I wanted to adapt these diaries to a film. And I said, absolutely.
Yeah, that Harvard history degree is finally paying off there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right.
And I can only even... Do you have any ideas for, you know, medieval films in the future? You could do something like a Game of Thrones or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It'd be fun to be watching from... Yeah,
a couple ideas, yeah.
So it'll be great to be watching your career trajectory because it looks bright and on an upward path. And so we're looking forward to both Union Bound coming out in about a year and a half. I'm a big buff of Civil War films, so I'll be definitely checking that one out and also be checking out your other film that will be released this coming month, which is called A Long Way Off. And I've been talking with John Arrington. John, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.